Welcome to Next on the Tee with Chris Mascaro, where tour players, legends, and the top instructors in the game share their stories, insights, and playing lessons. Join Chris every week as he talks with the greats of the game.
You are the smartest guy I've spoken to on radio or television in my career.
And Chris, again, you're knocking out of the park. You're like 8 under par in this interview.
By having any research, I'm hiring your tail to be the research man. You're the best.
You're a fantastic host and tremendously respected in the golf community.
Yeah, Chris, you do an amazing job, and your listeners are super lucky to have you, and it's always my pleasure.
Chris Mascaro is the king of the golf podcast. Don't miss him on Tuesdays.
Now, here's your host, Chris Mascaro.
Good evening, folks, and welcome to Next on the Tee. I'm your host, Chris Mascaro, and it's great having you back and a part of the show again with me this week. And I really appreciate the fact that you're allowing us to be a part of your weekly golf content. I want to send a shout out to the folks at the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, my hometown newspaper. Thank you to them, in particular, Jennifer Bertetto, for bringing this show to TribLive.com and the Trib Podcasting Network. It's a dream come true to have this show available in my hometown. It's an exciting development for me and one I'm very thankful for. Like I say, a dream come true for sure. Okay, on to this week's show, and I've got four guests that have great stories and insights that I'm looking forward to sharing with you. First up is going to be our resident director of instruction, Tom Patry. This week, I'm going to get TP's thoughts on Tiger telling the PGA Tour that he is going to join the Player Policy Board. We'll revisit whether JT did enough to show he belongs on the U.S. Ryder Cup team following his tied for 12th finish at the Wyndham Championship. We'll talk about some of the other guys who are making a bid to be on the team as well. And a shout out to one of our listeners, James Moran of the Expat Podcast, and his request to get some help from TP to fix his slice. So we'll have all of those things and a bunch more with Tom when he joins me here in just a few minutes. Following him, I'll get a return visit from former PGA Tour pro Richard Zokel. Richard played in 412 PGA Tour events from 1981 to 2001. I want to get his thoughts on what's going on around the game and with the PGA Tour and the PIF and all of that sort of thing. Plus, now he works at a company that he is developing called Mind Track Golf. So we'll dive into the mental side of the game a bit as well when he joins me about 25 minutes from now. After Richard, I'm going to get a long overdue return visit from equipment expert Michael Verska. Michael is a club fitting expert. He's worked for Wilson Adams Golf, and he's now over at Callaway. So we're going to talk about his start in golf, and it's sort of a hole in the wall gang, sort of baseball sort of thing that got him into golf. And we'll get into the club fitting and how he got started with that and a whole bunch more. Michael's a fantastic guy, and his knowledge is endless. So looking forward to having him back on the show. He'll join me later on in the hour. And then we're going to round things out with one of the most positive, energetic guys and a TV golf analyst, and that is Darren Pang. Panger, like I say, is just such a fantastic guy. He makes everything that he touches so much better because of his enthusiasm and his positive energy. He's also a Mura Golf Brand ambassador, and you'll hear why when he joins me, plus a guy that has just been absolutely everywhere, played some of the greatest golf courses around the world, and then obviously some here in the States as well with his time in St. Louis and then up in the Chicagoland area. He lives up in Michigan, so he's got a lot of golf experience playing some of the best golf courses, like I say, anywhere around the world. So really looking forward to having Darren back as part of the show. He'll join me at the top of the next hour. So we're going to have a lot of fun, folks, over the next couple of hours. And as always, thank you so much for tuning in and taking the journey with me tonight. I want to start out tonight by reminding you about our friends at the Macklemore, which is a private resort located just south of Chattanooga, high atop Lookout Mountain, Georgia. It's a casual 2-hour drive from Atlanta, Nashville, and Birmingham. The existing Highlands course is now ranked in the top 100 courses you can play in the United States by Golf Digest. The 18th hole, as a matter of fact, is ranked in the top 10 finishing holes in the world. A second course, the Outpost, is now under construction, which will open summer of 2024. The Outpost is another Bill Berg and Reese Jones design and features 1.5 miles of dramatic cliff edge, with every inch of that edge filled with a golf hole. A world-class hotel, Cloudland Lookout Mountain Curio Collection by Hilton, will open spring of 2024, Both the course and the hotel have incredible views into historic Macklemore Cove, 1,200 feet below. You gotta see it to believe it, folks. Stay, dine, and play golf above the clouds at Macklemore. Go online to Macklemore.com to book your stay and play package today. Now let's talk grips. I want to tell you about Lampkin grips. Every shot, as you know, has its own unique feel. The trick? Feel comfortable with each one. And comfort is built into the very DNA of Sonar Plus Black grips. Composed of their Genesis material that provides supreme comfort and durability, with their fingerprint technology, creates a strong connection and unforgettable touch. The game changes from shot to shot. The feel on your hand shouldn't. Lampkin. Feel is everything. I also want to remind you about the all-new Stealth 2 driver from TaylorMade. If there's one thing we know golfers want from a driver, it's distance. But there's actually two things we all want. Distance, and let's not forget, forgiveness. That's why TaylorMade designed the Stealth 2 driver with even more carbon for even more forgiveness. To learn more about the new Stealth 2 driver from TaylorMade, visit them online at TaylorMadeGolf.com. All right, now back for the 80th time.
What?
With me here on Next on the Tee is our resident director of instruction, Tom Patry. We're on the back nine of this year's golf season, but you're still out there trying to play your best, no doubt, every week. So do yourself a favor. If you can, get down to Naples, Florida, and go see Tom at Club Champion. If you're nowhere near there, well, then download the V1 video app. Select Tom as your instructor and send him videos of your golf swing through there. You can check out Tom online on his website, TomPatry.com, or on Instagram at TomPatryGolf. And as I always say, be sure to subscribe to his YouTube channel and watch those 300 free video playing lessons. And as always, it is a huge privilege to get to say this. Tom Patry is back with me again tonight here on Next on the Tee. Hey, TP, how are you, my friend?
Chrissy boy.
Ooh, a little harmony tonight for your 80th visit. I like it.
Is that right? Is it really 80 visits?
80 times tonight.
Why would you do that to yourself?
Seriously. I don't know. I ask myself that every other week. Why do I do this to myself? But here we are.
There we are.
All right, so let's get right into it, because I got to get your thoughts. Tiger Woods called up the PGA Tour, Jay Monahan or whoever, and told them he wanted to be on the player policy board. And I'm sure it was more of a statement than it was a question. But what do you make of Tiger giving him a call and say, hey, I'm on this board now?
You know, I called Jay too, and he didn't take my call, Chris. I don't understand.
Really?
Yeah, can you imagine that?
No.
Well, first of all, I think it's interesting on one hand that you just call the commissioner and you say, I want to be on, and they put you on like overnight virtually. It's not a process. It's not an interview. It's not. And I understand it's called Tiger Woods. I get it.
Yes.
I get it. But so that was kind of interesting to me that you just say, I'm on. So watch out, Jay. Here I am. I'm on. And it just happened. I thought that was an interesting twist. I'm also interested, relieved, excited, puzzled, and all the contrasting emotions that the overwhelming support that he's received from the players, which leads me to believe that there's still a lot of hard feelings from players towards Jay Monahan and the way things were done kind of covertly. And they want to make sure that it doesn't happen again. So they wanted to level the playing field. And they understand that, you know, that nobody would sit in the room with Tiger and just kind of go, hey, we're going to do this, right? And without any pushback or, you know, explain it to me in a little more detail. And let's get the player's opinion. So I think from a player's standpoint, it's really good. Really good that somebody like that is in the room who does have the best interest of the player in mind and best interest of tournament golf in mind. It's just interesting the way everything has happened these last 6 or 8 months. There's been so many bizarre twists and turns. This is just the next one. That's all. Just, you know, what's going to happen next? Maybe Bozo the Clown is going to be on the board next week or something. You know, I mean, you know, yeah, it's just, I mean, what could possibly happen next, Chris? I mean, that would shock us.
Yeah, and I don't know what that is, but I share your sentiments about having Tiger as a part of the board now. I mean, look, I have maintained throughout the last 18 months that he has been there shaking his head about what has happened, what has transpired, what the guys on the board have allowed to happen. And obviously this end around that Monahan did to bring the PIF and potentially the PGA Tour into a partnership. I mean, you go back to last summer when he had the players only meeting and he got Ricky and they got on the plane and they went up and had a players only meeting. Right. I'm sure he was sitting there shaking his head going, "You guys are a band of idiots. No, you sit there. I'm going to go have this conversation with the players to stem this tide for more guys going over to live." And then after this whole announcement, I thought he just was like, "You got to be kidding me. Seriously? All right. You know what? I've had enough of you guys making decisions. I'm, you know, he's Al Haig now. I'm in control." Right. So, and I think that's the right thing to do. I mean, look, the PGA Tour, and you know this better than I do, Tom, is supposed to be a players run tour. But for the longest time, it was the guys that were on the board who had never been players on the PGA Tour making decisions. And now we've got a 6-5 in the favor of the players on that board. Now we know one of the members resigned when he heard the news about this PIF merger partnership, whatever you want to call it. He was so disgusted, he resigned. So they've got a position to fill. But I think it should stay just the way it is right now. 6-5 in favor of the players. That way they ensure the fact that nothing like this is ever going to happen again. You're not going to be able to do an end around on us. You're not going to have the majority vote. It's not even going to be a tie. The players will decide what we do going forward. And oh, by the way, you can talk about who is the CEO of the PGA Tour. You can talk about who the chairman of the board is. It's Tiger Woods. Everything now is going to run through Tiger.
Yeah, I think he's certainly got a lot of clout. I mean, they'll put somebody else on there. It'll be a 6-6 situation, but you know, they'll be able to stalemate anything that happens. And certainly they'll get the news right away if something funny is going on to the membership. And if there's something funny going on like last time or an end around going on and again, and the word gets out, it's going to be ugly, Chris, really ugly. So I don't think there's any chance of that happening again. But, and you got, listen, whether you like Tiger or you don't like Tiger, whether you love Tiger or you don't love Tiger, It's great. It's great for the tour and great for the players that he's in that position now.
100%. All right, I want to talk a little bit about Justin Thomas. We've been talking about him the last few times you've been on the show, and we've talked about his struggles this season. But last weekend, finished tied for 12th at the Wyndham Championship. He ended up finishing 71st in the FedEx Cup standings. We all know the top 70 go on to the playoffs, so one spot outside of it. But his last three rounds in this tournament, 65, 66, 68, needed a birdie on that final hole to get up into that 70th spot. He nearly holed it from 30 yards. His pitch shot was right on line, bounced a couple of times, hit the stick, but didn't go in, unfortunately. But ultimately, that close to the playoffs, was what we saw from him over those three rounds of golf enough to show Captain Patry that he belongs on the Ryder Cup team?
No, Chris, it wasn't. I mean, and I'm going to start this by saying I'm a Justin Thomas fan. But you have six picks that are locked in already, you know, six that earned their way in. You have six guys behind that are, you know, 7 through 12. You've got to give these guys credit for getting themselves in that position. So what you're asking me to do is to leapfrog Justin Thomas over any number of those guys or any one of those guys who have earned the position they're in, because it's either a popularity contest or on past accolades. You have to go there to win that cup, and you've got to go there with the players that are playing the best right now. And he's not one of the players playing his best right now. And I think if he looked himself in the mirror and was honest, he would say that too. Now, is he going to take himself out of the running and say, hey, Zach, I'm going to take a pass on this. And, you know, I understand. Don't even worry about it. No, probably not. But he should. He should. It's too important, and it's too prestigious for guys who worked their rear ends off over the last 2 years to get themselves into this position to, because of a name who's played great golf in the past. He's played great golf on the team in the past, but is not in good form right now. Clearly not in good form right now. To you know, just give him the nod. I just don't think he can do that. I don't think it's the right thing to do.
So if we look at the top standings for the U.S. Ryder Cup points, Justin Thomas is 14. We know that there are 12 guys. The top six are automatically in. And then the guys after that are up to Zach Thomas and his co-captains for who they want as a part of the team. You know, 7 is Max Homa, 8 is Cam Young, 9 is Jordan Spieth, 10 is Keegan Bradley, 11 is Colin Morikawa, 12 is now Sam Burns, who leaped over Ricky Fowler. So if you went all chalk, those are the 12 guys. Now, like I say, Ricky's now 14, and Justin Thomas is right there. Ricky's now 13. I'm sorry, Justin Thomas now 14. So is there anything from Tom Patrick with those guys that are in the FedEx Cup playoff? Let's say Keegan Bradley plays terrible in the playoff. You know, doesn't make cuts, doesn't advance, he's out. Or anyone. I mean, I don't want to pick on Keegan. Just any one of those guys plays poorly. Like, look, Colin Morikawa hasn't exactly lit the world on fire this year.
Right, he hasn't. You're right. Absolutely not.
So when you think about any of those other guys, if any of them play poorly enough, going back to Justin, I mean, the guy's 16-5-3 in his President's Cup and Ryder Cup career. But those guys play bad enough. Do you go back and go, look, do I want a Justin Thomas, the fire, the experience, the guy that's not going to get nervous on the first tee at a Ryder Cup or in a match? Is there anything that could happen to change your opinion about who those guys should be?
Well, I mean, somebody has to play really poorly. And if anybody's going to leapfrog anybody right now, it's got to be Ricky Fowler, I think, because, I mean, he's certainly got some momentum right now. He's played great the second half of the year. I mean, great, not good. Great the second half of the year. Got back in the winner's circle. So if somebody's going to leapfrog somebody, it's going to be Ricky before Justin. And to have it to be Justin also, you're telling me two guys have to leapfrog two guys. See, that's a political fireball right there. And listen, we're not playing politics, we're playing golf. But I still don't see Justin Thomas. Sorry, I see Ricky possibly, very possibly. And I tell you right now, I mean, even before the playoffs start, you know, like you said, Colin Morikawa has not done anything in the second half of this year, and as has not Jordan Spieth. So, you know, even before the playoffs start, I'd be leaning hard on Ricky over one of those two players already.
The two guys at the end, again, Burns is 12, Ricky's 13. And Sam Burns, he had a tied for 14th last week. And like I say, that got him over ahead of Ricky in the standings. But I think people are kind of quick to dismiss him as a captain's pick. I mean, the guy did win the WGC match play event earlier this year, which speaks volumes. Obviously, you'd feel pretty good about him in a singles match at the Ryder Cup.
Right.
He's 19th in the FedEx Cup standings. Should he actually be getting more love? Should he have already been getting more love because of his last two seasons and winning at the WGC?
Yeah, he's played himself into that position for a reason. There's no doubt about it. Sam Burns is a fine player, and he's proven that, you know, on more than one occasion. And he's got a lot of grit, man. He's a grinder. So I mean, I wouldn't mind having him as my partner any day of the week, but. You know, I don't envy Zach Johnson right now, both from a golf standpoint and from a political standpoint. He's got a lot sitting on his plate right now, and you know, no matter what he does, he's going to get criticized. So, you know, we're being armchair quarterbacks right now and saying, you know, maybe this guy, maybe that guy. Why not this guy? Why not that guy? But we're not the guy actually making the decision. He's got a lot on his plate right now, and I don't envy his position at all.
Speaking of the why not that guy, and I know what Mrs. Patrick would say to this, and I know you don't care much about it. Bryson DeChambeau won his first LIV Tour event, and he did so in pretty grand fashion, shooting a 58 in the final round, draining about a 35-footer for that 58. And regardless of the tour, I mean, he played it at the Greenbrier. He played PGA Tour events there for decades. That's not a slouch of a golf course. Shouldn't Bryson get a little love? I mean, the guy played pretty darn well last go round, 2-0-1 in his Ryder Cup matches. Seems like he should get a little consideration.
Chris, I'm a PGA member, a longstanding PGA member. You know how I feel about the game of golf. It's my life. I'm a big love guy of team competition. I love the President's Cup. I love the Ryder Cup. If Bryson DeChambeau is on the Ryder Cup team, I can promise you I will not turn on the TV set.
Oh, That's as harsh as Mrs. Patry on this.
I will not turn on the TV set because if I do, Mrs. Patry will throw something. No, I have no love for Bryce DeChambeau. I could care less. I mean, but if he's on that team, I'm not turning on the TV. I'm not going to watch it.
All right, let's switch gears a little bit. Let's go over to the Champions Tour because I want to get your thoughts on the Senior Open. Alex Krejci prevailed in a playoff over Padraig Harrington, but they played in brutal conditions during the final rounds. And for those folks who didn't see it, the round of the day was shot by our friend Rob LeBritz in round four. He shot an even par 71. That was the best round of the day. 26 players shot 80 or worse in that round. And Rob had a heck of a turnaround because he shot 86 in the third round.
Right.
Krejci, Harrington, Vijay. Those were the top three guys. And again, Krejci and Harrington went into a playoff. But those three guys shot 76, 75, 77, respectively, in the final round. Tom, one of the things I think that speaks to is you've got to be pretty mentally tough to kind of stay in it when course conditions are that bad and try to go out there and post the best number that you can based on what you're dealing with out there. But talk about that.
Yeah, I love playing overseas. I'm a big fan of links golf. I've always have been. And it really started because I grew up on the east end of Long Island out towards Shinnecock Hills. And I remember playing high school golf in March on the east end of Long Island and be, 45 degrees and late in the day, the sun would be dropping. It would drop down into high 30s. And you'd get a little sleep going out there and stuff. And you'd be freezing your rear end off. And then I remember as an adult, for the first time going over to Scotland, I was so excited to go over the first time. And I remember it was an October trip. And the first 2 days, it was glorious. It was, 65 and sunny and no wind and just perfect. And then the third day, all hell broke loose. We're at Carnoustie. And if you've never played Carnoustie, Chris, it's when you die, if you're sent to hell, you have to play Carnoustie and Oakmont date back to back every day for the rest of your life. Every day for the rest of your life. And the temperature dropped to the mid 40s. The wind started blowing 35 miles an hour. It started raining. And it was already the hardest golf course on the planet that I'd ever seen. It was brutal. And I have no problem saying I shot one of the greatest 85s of my career that day. And it felt like 65. For people who've never played in those conditions on a links golf course with the wind blowing sideways, you can't explain how hard it is. You can't explain how difficult it is to get the ball in the hole. You can't explain that a docile 420-yard par four that's slightly uphill into the wind all of a sudden plays 600 yards. I mean, just and downwind, it seems like it's going to be easy, but if you have a little wedge shot into the green, you can't even come close to controlling the ball, stopping or making it spin. In bunker shots, the sand's blowing everywhere. On the green, your rain pants are flapping and you're not in balance, and you can't explain to people how hard it is. And listen, we know how talented those guys are. We know how good they are. They're the best in the world as seniors. They shoot unbelievable scores day in and day out. And when they shoot those kind of scores, you have to understand that something unusual is going on out there.
Tom, and Jay Monahan's big return to his job on the PGA Tour. He announced that the tour would not be adopting the model local rule, rolling the golf ball back. They seem to agree that there's a distance problem. They just don't support the fact that the golf ball is where that problem lies or how to solve it. We know that the USGA and the RNA were for it. We know that Fred Ridley and Augusta National was going to support it. So where does everybody go from here?
Chris, who won the Open Championship?
Brian Harman.
Is Brian Harman in the top third on the PGA Tour in driving distance?
He is not.
Is he in the top half in driving distance?
Probably not.
Okay. But he won the Open Championship, right?
He did.
And he won it over players that hit vast distances longer than him, did he not?
He did.
He was playing with the same ball they were playing with, was he not?
He was.
Okay. It's not the ball, and that's not the answer. Okay. Now, the USGA is going to press this thing, and the RNA is going to press this thing, and they're probably going to get, you know, aligned properly with the, you know, with Augusta National and different governing bodies. And the PGA Tour is going to say, you know what, we're not buying into this and it's not the deal for us. And it's going to be a division and it's going to be ugly and it's going to be the next controversy. And I just think that the ball is not the answer. That's not the, I mean, listen, I don't think you go backwards. You know, I think the whole, listen, they screwed up the long putter situation. They did a wonderful job with that. And now they're screwing up this. They're unbelievably talented at screwing this thing up. They do this so well every time they decide to get on their soapbox on a different topic. I don't think the ball's the answer.
So where do you go though? I mean, if that's it, and I think that's, I mean, look, I would have to imagine, and I'm going to talk to Michael Verska about this a little bit later on in the show. But if I'm a manufacturer, I would think that the cost for me to retool my entire plant, right? I mean, they make millions of golf balls, right? I mean, to retool a plant to change all of that has got to be an ungodly expense to do that. So that's why I got to believe that, you know, not only is Monahan and the players against this, I got to believe that the manufacturers aren't on board with this either. Now, if I was going to change something, I don't know, could I change? I've heard a lot of people suggest changing the size of the driver head because, as you know, back in the day, and this goes back to Persimmon Woods and Bellotta golf ball, but the hardest club to hit in the bag, unless you were Jack Nicklaus, was, you know, a one iron or a driver. I mean, the driver was the hardest thing for anybody to hit. And now it's probably one of the easiest clubs to hit because we have twist face and cup face and trampoline and, you know, all that stuff that's happening on the driver head. And it's, you know, you're swinging a, you know, a club like the Flintstones used to have because of the size of the head. I just got to believe that maybe we pivot that direction. I don't know. What do you think?
Chris, what was the winning score at Oak Hill for the PGA Championship?
I have to go back and look, but.
It wasn't 20 under, right?
It was not. No.
Okay. It wasn't. I don't think it was 10 under, was it?
I would guess it was in the single digits, but I'll look while you're talking.
Okay. So why were the scores higher there? It was the same ball,
right?
So what was different?
Yeah, course setup is the other thing people are pointing to.
So listen, when I play golf and you play golf, and I play on a very nice condition golf course, Crown Colony. It's in great shape. During season, my superintendent does a wonderful job, and I hit a good drive. It might roll 10 or 12 yards when it lands, okay, if it's properly struck. And you turn on CBS on Sunday afternoon, and somebody hits a drive and it lands, and we see that thing roll 40 yards on the ground, 40 on the ground. And they go, oh, he hit it 340. No, he hit it 298 or 297, and it rolled 45 yards, okay? And then they get into this thing called rough on a day, on a week to week basis, other than majors. And the rough looks something like my living room shag carpet. There's nothing there. And the greens putt perfectly and they're nice and receptive. So if we change those course conditions on a regular basis and we put a little bit more water in the fairways, and the fairways actually had rough on either side of the center line, and the green conditions were a little firmer, we wouldn't be having this discussion right now.
Okay? And Bruce Koepka was 9 under at the PGA Championship.
There you go. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Your Honor, I rest my case. Can we bring in the next idiots? Listen, let me finish this though. The golf ball is an incredible instrument compared to what I played with, let's say, during my college days. You go back to the Bellotta ball, which we thought was a Cadillac. And it's actually an Etzel by today's comparison. So is the golf ball the most incredible instrument in my bag? It's more incredible than my driver. It's more incredible than my Scotty Cameron putter or my Vokey wedges. It's an incredible piece of equipment compared to what we're used to in the past in this game. Are my clubs better? Are the shafts I'm using just unimaginable compared to where I came from? Absolutely. But the agronomy, I think, is something we have to point to. And course conditions on tour lend to low scores and long golf balls. Okay. And you know what? Birdies and eagles are exciting. But we all like to watch that occasional car crash, don't we? We like to see that wreck on turn three. So we can do that by changing course conditions. And these guys are so talented, they're just going to shoot. Somebody's still going to shoot a good score every week. Okay. Somebody's, when you put that many talented people together, somebody's going to shoot a low score. Okay. But the course conditions far outweigh, I think, the golf ball right now.
One of the big things still left to decide this season is who's going to be player of the year. The two favorites right now are John Rahm and Scottie Scheffler. Rahm, of course, won the Masters, finished tied for second at the Open, and tied for 10th at the U.S. Open. But Scheffler's been the more consistent player. I mean, he had a streak of 19 straight top 12 finishes until the Open when he finished tied for 23rd. But going back to early this season, he won the Players' Championship. And those two guys, you think, are going to be fighting it out. And we'll see how they do the rest of the playoffs. But is it really just those two guys? Is there someone else you think that should be in the discussion? Has one of those guys already won it, in your opinion? What do you think about the player of the year discussion?
No, those are certainly your two frontrunners, no doubt about it. They both had incredible years. I think that without singling out anybody by name right now, one of those players is extremely popular among his peers and is going to be a player vote. And one of them isn't quite as popular for various reasons. Okay. And unfortunately, what will probably happen is probably it'll turn into a player of the year / popularity contest vote. And this one player will win over the other player. Not that he should or shouldn't win, but I'm not sure he'll win for all the right reasons. And that's unfortunate, because the other player who doesn't get the vote had a great year too. I think it's so close in different ways. One was more consistent, but one did something extremely dramatic at a very prestigious event. You know, could it be a co-player of the year? It could, it won't happen, but there could. I think it's going to turn into a little bit of a popularity vote, though.
Tom, one more before I let you go, and I want to get a playing lesson from you, because one of our listeners on the Expat Podcast, their host James Doran, reached out and asked for help with his slice. So for those of us who struggle with slicing the golf ball off the tee, what are some tips that you can give James and the rest of us to help us keep it in the fairway?
I wish James would help me with mine right now, because mine's not going. Mine's not always going where I want it to go either right now. It's funny, Chris, because I hit a fade, and my miss is when I overcut it or overfade it, and it goes from a power fade to a balloon ball that looks like a dying quail. So I'm well versed in that era. You know, the first thing I always check when players have a face condition, and to me, listen, the two things that affect ball flight in terms of curvature the most are face and path. Those are the two big kahunas. There are other factors, but those are the two big kahunas. And I always tell people when I teach them, I said, listen, the face is king and path is the queen. Okay. The face is the big kahuna. So the first thing you've got to control is the face. That's the biggest thing you can get your arms wrapped around. So I'm going to tell you, James, if you're hitting a really big banana ball or slice to the right, that the face condition is definitely going to be to some degree open and impact. So the first thing you check when we have a face problem, the first thing I check is the grip, particularly the left hand grip. Is it in the fingers enough? Is it in a strong enough condition? And it's probably not. It's funny, Chris, every single lesson I give to a club member or a recreational golfer, the first thing I do is ask them to put their hands on the club, and I go through a grip check, and 99.9% of the time, I find the left hand grip up in the palm of the hand somewhere. And I say to them, listen, if you want to hit bananas to the right, and do you do that? They go, yeah, Tom, we do. We do that a lot. I said, well, you're supposed to. With that grip, you're supposed to hit it just where you're hitting it. So I make that check and that change first if I have to. And usually that, you're a miracle worker. No, I'm not a miracle worker. It's just, it's cause and effect. And we check the big culprit, which was the grip, which affects the face. From there, we work on path. And one of the things that is so great about this when people don't believe you, Chris, is all you have to do is put on TrackMan and just put two data tiles up. You have to put path and face up. And if you see those big negative numbers come up on path, which means the club is coming over the top and across the line, and then the face is open or very, very positive, you need a guy sitting there, beautiful pull, banana cut. So if you square the face up, then he hits a pull, and that, well, that feels strong all of a sudden. It feels really good. Those pulls go a long way, but except unfortunately, they go a long ways offline. So now we've got the face squared up. Now we got to get the path, and we got to get the path moving a little more or slightly more into out. So that's a progressive change. It doesn't happen overnight. Everybody thinks it's going to happen in 30 minutes. They're sadly mistaken. You don't change a motor skill tendency in 30 minutes. But to James out there, please check your left-hand grip first.
Tom, before I let you go, remind our listeners, how can they stay up to date with all the great things you're doing? Get your tips and lessons online and on your website and social media.
So, Chris, let me do one correction from my wonderful host, the greatest host in the world on Golf Podcast. The Club Champion thing is coming to an end. It is basically sold out till I'm done there, which is mid-September. So there's no more availability there at all. I'm both sad and happy to say. It's been a great summer season. I'll take a little bit of a brief break, and I'll start back up at the Golf Club at Crown Colony on October 20th. Tom's got a little golf coming up. He's got a couple of trips to Key West to do some fishing. He's got the Sexton Senior Championship and the Chapter Senior Championship coming up. I'm pretty excited about both of those. I've been working on my game a little bit. Hopefully, I won't fall on my face. So I'll play those two events. So I know you'll be bugging me about what you shoot. I'm actually going over there tomorrow night to play a practice round the following day at Lost Tree with Matt Cale, the pro at Seminole, following morning. I'm excited about that. But as far as keeping up, pre-Crown Colony and knowing what's going on, you know, all the obvious places, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, you know, yada, yada, yada. And they can subscribe to my newsletter if they want on my website at www.tompetry.com. But more importantly, you can keep up with me on the greatest podcast in the world, hosted by Chris Mascaro every other Tuesday night here on Next on the Tee, because he is the greatest guy on the waves.
I appreciate you very much, TP. You're the best, my friend. Well, the best of luck over at those golf tournaments and getting your game in shape and the practice rounds and all that sort of thing. You're right. I will be bugging the heck out of you to hear how well you did, not only because I want to know, but all of our listeners want to know as well.
I'll do my best, my friend. I promise.
Stay safe, my friend. All the best in your family. I'm already looking forward to 2 weeks from tonight.
Love you, pal. You're the best.
Thanks, Tom. See you, buddy.
Bye.
That is the great Tom Patry, folks, and they just don't come better than that guy. That's a huge blessing every other week that we get to have him as part of the show and get his insights, pick his brain, get some tips as well. Again, be sure to follow him on his website, tompatry.com, P-A-T-R-I is the spelling of his last name, at Tom Patry Golf on Instagram. And again, go out there on his YouTube channel, get those free lessons, folks. They're really going to make a difference in how well you play. Looking forward to catching up with Tom again in a couple of. Okay, coming up next is a guy who helped BYU win the 1980 National Championship. He's in the British Columbia Golf Hall of Fame and the Canadian Golf Hall of Fame, and that is Richard Zokel. Before I get to Richard of the teaching spectrum, and that is Dr. Allison Kurt. Before I get to Allison, I was talking with Eddie Dry, VP of Domestic Sales for Strixon Cleveland Golf, at the PGA Merchandise Show earlier this year, and I said, Eddie, I like your CBX full-face wedges. How can they help an average player like me play better? Here's what he had to say.
An average player, I use one, and I'm in some lies that you can't even believe. And I need all the help I can get. And the face is bigger, and the grooves go all the way up and all the way out to the toe. So if you hit it on the toe, you miss it, bam, there's a groove. So I like that. So I carry a 58.
There you have it, folks. Try the new CBX full-face wedges from Cleveland Golf. I want to tell you about something else I saw at the PGA Merchandise Show, and that's me and my golf. And how does a 45-day free trial to Arco sound? Well, me and my golf have partnered with Arcos and are offering 14 free sensors and a 45-day free trial to Arcos Caddy when you purchase any training aid on shop.meandmygolf.com. This is a limited time offer, so don't miss out. Again, go online to shop.meandmygolf.com. With many years in the business, menswear brand Construct has finally launched its Green Golf Collection, sustainably produced using renewable solar energy and recycled fabrics. Hit your best shot in their performance-enhancing polos, quarter zips, and bottoms. Made with four-way stretch, quick dry, and UV 50 plus protection. From solids to bold, eye-catching designs, Construct Green is the perfect piece for making the best memories on the greens. And the best part? You can head to construct.com, and that's ConstructCT.com, and use code Chris for 20% off the green collection today. Now back and next on the tee with me, and making his seventh appearance on this show, is former PGA Tour pro Richard Zokel. Let me remind you about his background. He's from Kitimat, British Columbia, which is on the coast in the central part of the province. He played his college golf at Brigham Young from 1977 to 1981, where he helped them to first or second place finishes in the Western Athletic Conference all 4 years he was there. They finished second in the national championship in 1980. A year later, he captained them to the 1981 national championship. Individually, Richard won the International Champions Tournament over in Morocco in 1980. In 2009, that 81 BYU golf team, well, they were inducted into the Brigham Young Athletics Hall of Fame. That year, he was also inducted into the British Columbia Golf Hall of Fame. Richard won the 1981 Canadian Amateur Championship by a stroke over Blaine McAllister in a sudden death playoff, and then he turned pro. Among his other wins were the 1982 British Columbia Open and the 1984 Utah State Open. On the PGA Tour, he won twice in 1992 at the Deposit Guarantee Classic and the Greater Milwaukee Open. In 2001, he won the Canadian PGA Championship, and in 2011, he was inducted into the Canadian Golf Hall of Fame. He is now the founder and CEO of MindTrack Golf, which you can find online at mindtrackgolf.com, and track is spelled T-R-A-K, so mindtrackgolf.com again is the website, and I couldn't be more honored that he is back with me again tonight here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Richard, thanks for coming back on the show.
Hey, Chris, it's a pleasure to be with you, and you're very gracious in your due diligence and in your research. So thank you very much. Good to talk with you.
Absolutely. So, Richard, it's been a minute since we got to have you as part of the show. Catch us up. What's been going on with you?
Well, life is proceeding. There's no doubt about that. It's interesting to listen to all the antics that you were just talking with your last guest, Tom Patry, and fascinating stuff. I really enjoyed what Tom had to say, and could tell that he has a lot of knowledge and really enjoyed his perspective up until he talked about the golf ball, Chris. It sounded to me like he was coming out of the Titleist playbook, but interesting stuff. Lots to talk about. Where do you want to begin?
Well, let's start right there. Give me your thoughts. As a guy who played on tour for a couple of decades, give me your thoughts on where do we go with this thing? If the PGA Tour doesn't want to adopt the model local rule, then we, and on the opposite side of that, obviously, we had the USGA and the RNA that were in favor of it. Fred Ridley and Augusta National said they'd support it. Where do we go?
Well, it's adding to the conundrum that's already confusing. And if you don't mind, I do want to back up a little bit. Prior to that, on the PGA Tour, where, you know, for decades, the PGA Tour, as you mentioned, was a players run tour. And you know, and that came about because it came from the statements of the three commissioners. And unfortunately, all the players swallowed it hook, line, and sinker. And what, unfortunately, in this mess that we're in, all of us who play this game have been watching the PGA Tour, found out that that's just not the case. And it's been an argument that many of us about 20 years ago was trying to make progress with on the PGA Tour, that, you know, there was a bunch of us wanting to look into the books of the PGA Tour and find out not only where the money was coming from, but how it was being distributed and what governances were going on. And it was very difficult to get that information. There was no transparency whatsoever to the members. So the whole notion that this was a players' tour, is just not the case. And now I think that with Tiger being given a position on the policy board is good, because I think the players are going to have a lot of faith in Tiger, whereas they've lost a lot of faith in the commissioner because of what we watched unfold, these decisions being made before even other players on the players on the policy board even found out, was just a bit of a shock. And I think there needs to be some restructuring. Either the players have control of the board, which they do not right now, and I think they should, or have a situation, Chris, where there is an election to the board of directors, and that's controlled by the players, all the players voting at an annual general meeting, an election to the board. One of those pathways would give the players control and make sure that they move in the right direction. Now we're in a bit of a mess because, you know, the public investment fund of Saudi Arabia is going to be funding the PGA Tour. And even though Jay Monahan's going to be, you know, the commissioner of it, the chairman's going to be His Excellency Yasir Al-Rumayyan. And he's going to have his hand on the faucet that flows billions of dollars into the PGA Tour. And the last time I recall what the name of this is, Chris, is the Golden Rule. And the man with the gold makes the rule. So it is a bit of a conundrum. Well, I mean, and a lot of people don't like it. And there's going to be a lot, there is a lot of moving parts in this. And I think that, and now that it's going to be interesting to see how things unfold. And there's going to be this taintedness in the PGA Tour and professional golf right now, because I think there's going to be no stopping the PIF. They're going to be going in and perhaps looking at other sports as well, the LPGA, and unfortunately, too many people and organizations will want to grab the money, and it's just unfortunately moving in the wrong direction. Now on the golf ball, I think that I am a believer of the ball is a significant part of the problem. I think you're right, and the head is part of the problem too, and the size of the sweet spot is a part of the problem. But I'd love to see that golf ball spin more. And I think what would happen in an argument to Tom Patry's argument is that no player on the PGA Tour, when you ask them, do you want to hit it shorter? There isn't a golfer that would say, yeah, I do want to hit it shorter. There's no way with that. That doesn't work. But what will happen if they make that ball spin more, then those that are hitting their tee shots with reckless abandon, and there's a lot of those players, are going to have to would find the rough and the trees a lot more. And the guys like Brian Harman, who are top quality ball strikers, they would be getting an advantage in their ability to ball strike compared to the average player on the PGA Tour. And I think that is the skill, and that is why the USGA is trying to pull back. And I think the ball's just the first step. I think they need to bifurcate and make that head smaller for the professional player. And quite frankly, yes, it's going to cost the dig into the profits from all the golf ball manufacturers. But boy, oh boy, have they made out like bandits, the way it has in the past few decades. So those are my top of the line thoughts on the PGA Tour and the ball. And happy to answer any more questions.
Yeah, so you mentioned faith a minute ago, and players having faith in the tour and in Jay Monahan. Mm-hmm. If you were out there playing on the tour, and could you trust Jay Monahan? Could you have faith in the guys that have been leading the tour? Again, not the players, but the other guys on the board of directors, and then Jay himself as CEO. Could you have faith in them anymore after what's happened?
Well, there's definitely going to be a change, because you saw a year ago with the way Jay was talking to Jim Nance at the Canadian Open and looking into the camera and saying that, you know, this is sport washing and we don't do that. We're above this. And he was, you know, you got Rory McIlroy, who did a brilliant job on putting the PGA Tour on his shoulders and fighting for his beliefs and the PGA Tour side against the PIF of Saudi, and Jay talking to Congress and trying to get them involved. And then, and with Rory doing such a remarkable job, winning the way he did it, he stuck his neck out and he got his neck chopped off, basically. And now when this announcement, the surprise that Jay and Yashir El-Ramayan were on television together before they made an announcement to everyone, you're going to feel betrayed. I feel I don't even play on the PGA Tour anymore. I'm a life member, but I feel betrayed. And so there's this capitulation again that's happened. And the PGA Tour capitulated on the Ping with the Ping lawsuit back in 1992 or three, I think it was, on the courthouse steps, because they didn't want to lose. And it's a really unfortunate that the PGA Tour, and I think it has to fall on Jay Monahan's shoulders, is that, you know, like, you know, did they have to spend that much money for that palatial clubhouse or headquarters? You know, spending the money for them to, and they were in such a good position legally, both in the European side and on the American side on their fight against it. But when push comes to shove and they realized they didn't have the funds to sustain this, that then you capitulate. It was really a sad day for golf. And I think, to answer your question, yes, you would lose faith in Jay Monahan as a commissioner. Now he's getting a chance to perhaps earn it back. But this is where Tiger comes in. I think Tiger is going to be the new leader of the PGA Tour, and I think the players do have faith in Tiger Woods.
Yeah, and I agree 100% with that, Richard. I mean, I think Tiger has been disappointed by what he has seen, and I don't know Tiger, and I'm projecting on him, but when I look at a guy like Tiger that has gone through all the things that he's gone through, and now he's spending a lot of time with Charlie and his family and all those sorts of things, I almost feel like he's Michael Corleone. Like, you know, just when I thought I was out, they pull me back in. You know, he's got to come in because the players, I think, look to him as they have for decades for leadership. And the guy that's been the face of the tour and all of that sort of thing, and we all know he moves the needle and is the needle. Now he's got to come back in, and I think he's got to assert himself. And I don't know if he wanted to do that, but I think he needed to do that. And I think the players, if there's one person all of the players can trust, I think they feel like it's Tiger Woods. And he had to come in and become a part of this the policy board. And I think you're right, Richard. I think he is the guy now. Say all you want about Jay Monahan and his in his position and the other guys that are on the board of directors. I think Tiger Woods is the guy that's going to call the shots from now.
I think you're right. In you know, this, when his father said Tiger's got a higher calling, I think now that his best days are behind him, and that doesn't mean he still can't go out there and perhaps win a major or two, you know, in the future. But the fact that he took this side, him and Rory, and there is no chance Tiger Woods will capitulate. It's just not in his DNA. And I think, you know, and all of us are wondering what happened, where Tiger was, and we were waiting for his comments and hadn't heard anything. But I think his higher calling is to, you know, to do the best for the PGA, to represent the players. And I think the players want him to do that. I would have faith in Tiger Woods right now more than anyone else. And so I think you're on track with that one, Chris.
And Richard, you mentioned how much money they've been spending. I mean, we've seen purses go through the roof. I mean, $20 million purses. I mean, some of the elevated events have higher purses than the majors do. Needing the money. Is this a thing where the PGA Tour was trying so hard to try to compete with the Live Tour and the amount of money and all that sort of stuff? And they started to squeeze their sponsors for more and more money. And there just wasn't any more money that was going to come. Now, going to the PIF and getting the money and doing the very thing that they told the players not to do, right? Don't go to Live. Don't take their money. As you pointed out, you know, all the negative stuff that was said about the PIF and the Saudi money and all that sort of stuff. Was the fact that things were escalating and these purses needed to escalate, did it leave them no opportunity? We know about the legal fees and all of that the PIF could have spent them into bankruptcy and legal fees.
But the escalated purses were something they couldn't afford to do,
sponsors couldn't ante up any more money. They were going to have to dip into their reserves. So now they were getting tournament purses that they couldn't pay on going forward. So not only did they have to go to the PIF to stop the legal fee battle, but they also had to go to the PIF because players wanted these escalated purses. They wanted to get paid more, and there was no more money coming for the PGA Tour from their coffers.
Well, needing to do it, I think, there's this greed factor that was presented to all these players and those who chose to go for that, you know, to jump ship to the LIV Tour. You know, they did it for the money. And for whatever reason, and you know what, that's their prerogative. However, what the threat that it put onto the PGA Tour, they needed to accelerate their money the way they did in order to put a plug in the dam before the dam burst. And that is what they needed to do. And as they started to respond, they basically brought a knife to a gunfight. And once they found out that they couldn't sustain this money give to the players, the writing was on the wall. There was no possibility that they were going to win, even if they won in court. You know, the sponsors on the PGA Tour could not sustain that level. So the writing was on the wall, and that's when their decision is either we die here, or we wave the white flag and we capitulate and form something that we could possibly have control over, which is what they're trying to figure out now. And also the thing is, what a lot of people don't understand is that when they went into this framework agreement, and this is just like a memorandum of understanding. So it locks these two entities together to spend, usually it's about, you know, what it could be 60, 90 days. In this case, it's 6 months for them to figure it out. And this does not mean whatsoever this is going to be happening, because it does have to pass whatever the framework they do. It has to pass the policy board, and Tiger is going to be up there scrutinizing this thing with the rest of the players. And if it does pass the policy board, the biggest concern is now that Congress is sniffing around and inviting, Ron Price and Jimmy Dunn, and now they're summoning Yasir Al-Rumayyan to Congress. The Federal Trade Commission is going to take a look at this, and there's going to be this no monopoly desire, and that's one of the concerns, I think, where Randall Stevens, the policy board member on the PGA Tour, where he resigned, he was the former CEO, I think, chairman of AT&T. Like, he probably very much remembers that time when Time Warner was trying to buy AT&T, and the Federal Trade Commission did not allow it. They ordered that there had to be disbanded, and just simply because they wouldn't allow a monopoly to happen. So these two hurdles that have to pass, that's going to, you know, be the end of this year with the policy board looking at what this new venture is going to be by the ownership of PIF and the PGA Tour, and it has to get ratified, and then we need to watch and find out what the Federal Trade Commission is going to do, because that's going to be very interesting.
So let's take that a step further. Let's say it doesn't pass. I mean, they're not allowed to merge for whatever reason, and we've seen what's happened with right now. If it does go through, right, and a lot of players are upset. Mm-hmm. I should have taken the money because there wasn't going to be a path back and all this other stuff. Well, now it appears like that's not true. But let's say, hey, it doesn't go through, and now there's this partnership doesn't happen, and LIV is going to be a completely separate entity, and more money is out there for some of these players to go. And you're going to,
yeah.
I mean, could this get really, really ugly where got a huge separation and more players go to LIV, and it just doesn't feel good, Richard.
It doesn't feel good at all. It's awful. And I think that is a possibility. If this thing hinges on the Federal Trade Commission, then, because right now the way the political situation in Washington is with the national security and with these foreign governments, mainly China and Russia, buying up assets that are long-term American icons and land. You know, they're looking at this as a national security issue, and who knows where that politics is going. And you know, we're in a very sensitive state. But you know, one of the things I must say is when you look at, you know, let's take a look at this past week. What's uncovered when I look at the PGA Tour, and I look, okay, here's we got Bryson DeChambeau shooting 58, and that's interesting, and all that and that stuff. And I watched it. I wanted to see what that was all about. But I also watched Lucas Glover in his situation, you know, in the past 6 months and evolving. And when Lucas Glover won that tournament, I had tears in my eyes. And I'm kind of looking at this and going, you know, there isn't a live tournament that's going to make me cry, but the meaningfulness of the PGA Tour, you know, it's in a precarious position right now, and I'm hoping that it gets figured out. And I'm not sure. I mean, this is what money does, and we're all watching Randall Chambly do his thing with Eamon Lynch, talk about, you know, their antics with their, and their fighting, and you know, so boy, this is a real tenuous situation, and we're going to just have to see how it's going to unfold.
Richard, one more before I let you go, and I want you to remind everybody about MindTrack Golf and the things that you're doing now.
Yeah, well, MindTrack is we're a unique mindset fitness protocol that conditions and helps golfers, you know, access the present moment. And you know, it's something that we're working on. We're talking to a number of companies. We're talking to some governing bodies. Like any startup company, it's taking a lot longer than I hoped it would. But it's something that is so meaningful. And you know, when you look at Brian Harman talk about, you know, Mike Tirico asked him, you know, were you able to not get ahead of myself? And Brian Harman winning the Open Championship says that it's exactly the thing that caused him to win. He didn't actually think about winning. He didn't allow himself to think about what it meant until he got out of that bunker shot and on the green. And these things, even the best players in the world need to learn how to access that present moment. We're the protocol that teaches this. We're very unique, it's something that you do on the golf course, and I can't wait to expand the company and really connect with all the players who take this game very seriously.
So Richard, let our listeners know, how can they stay up to date with all the great things you're doing there at MindTrack and follow you, whether it's online or it's on social media?
Well, you can get on our website, mindtrackgolf.com. And as you mentioned, there's no C in it when you spell MindTrack. And there we have some videos in there that you can take a look at. And I'm also on Twitter at Richard Zokel.
Richard, I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your night to come back and be a part of the show again tonight. You're endlessly fascinating. I love your viewpoints and your stories. I hope we get the privilege of having you back on the show again soon.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Chris. It's always a pleasure speaking with you. And thank you very much.
Richard, take care. All the best to you and your family. We'll catch up
soon.
Will
do. Thank you.
See you, Richard. That is the great Richard Zokel. And again, MindTrack Golf, and T-R-A-K is the spelling of track. So mindtrackgolf.com at Richard Zokel, Z-O-K-O-L is the spelling of his last name. Give him a follow on Twitter, I guess. Is it X? Is it Twitter? What are we calling it now? But give him a follow there. And like I said, I love his insights and his stories, and hopefully we'll get a little more from him next time, because there's a lot more to get into with MindTrack and staying in the moment and not getting ahead of ourselves, because that's one of the things I know I do, right? You got a good round going. Well, I've made 4 pars, 5 pars, 6 pars in a row. Ooh, I could shoot this, or ooh, I could shoot that. And the next thing you know, we make double and triple, and we've blown it because we got ahead of ourselves. Richard's got a great thing going there at MindTrack Golf. Hopefully we'll get that opportunity to get a little more into it the next time he joins. Joining me next is going to be Michael Verska. Michael is an equipment expert, one of the best that we have in our game. Before I get to Michael, I want to remind you about 2Under, men's performance wear. They're the unofficial underwear of the PGA and the 2020 Ryder Cup team. Ricky Fowler is their global ambassador, and over 50 other PGA, Korn Ferry, and Champions Tour players wear them. Just to mention a few, like David Toms, Jerry Kelly, Justin Thomas, William McGirt, Scott McCarron, and Chris DeMarco. The Joey Pouch technology provides the ultimate male asset management, delivering maximum comfort from the tee box to the boardroom to the bedroom. Use code NEXT20 to save 20% off your order at 2under.com. That's the number 2, UNDR.com. 2under, performance in your pants. And you walk a lot of miles in life and on the course, so make sure you're walking in the right shoes. Skoni changes the game with an affordable line of the most comfortable, versatile, slip-on golf shoes that can be worn anywhere. They're made with breathable microfiber fabric, spikeless treads, and an adjustable lace lock. And they're easy to clean, too. So spend less time changing shoes and more time living in them. Visit skoni.com and use code NXTONT20. So next on T20 at checkout for 20% off. That's skoni.com, SKONI.com. They're also available at golf specialty retailers and green grass pro shops nationwide.
Relax.
Easy now. Find your happy place. It's all in the hips. Just tap it in.
Yes!
Find the latest clubs and apparel at golf's happy place, the PGA Tour Superstore.
All right, now back and making a long overdue fourth visit with me here on Next on the Tee is equipment expert Michael Verska. Let me remind you a little bit about his background. He graduated from Purdue University with his Bachelor of Science degree in Mechanical Engineering. While he was in school, he worked for U.S. Steel from 1993 to 1999. And in June of 99, he went to work for Wilson as a project engineer and later as a principal engineer. 2002, he joined Adams Golf as a design engineer and later became the director of product development. He rejoined Wilson in October of 2011 as their global director of innovation and later spent time as their global director of golf R&D. He is now a director of custom fitting and player performance at Callaway Golf, and I'm excited he is back with me again tonight here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Michael, thanks for coming back on the show.
Hey, thanks for the introduction, Chris. It's been way too long, but I do certainly appreciate having you on, having me on again. It's good to talk to you.
Absolutely. And like I say, Michael, it has been a minute. Catch us up. What's been going on with you?
So I think it's been 4 or 5 years since you and I have talked, which is maybe less than that, but it feels like forever. So yeah, I'm at Callaway now and been there for actually a little over 4 years. I think you mentioned my title, Director of Custom Fitting and Player Performance. So I'm really focused on the big picture fitting initiatives, you know, how do we help players get in the better clubs and the better golf balls? And then doing some other cool stuff that's not really out yet, kind of longer term projects, but how else do we help players play better? Looking at, things like data and nutrition and physical things and tying some things from the tour into that long term. So yeah, some really fun times. Callaway is obviously a great company to work for. We're doing some amazing things with the top golf side and Top Tracer, now fully in and getting to work with that team some. So it's been fun. It's good times.
Michael, because it's been a little while, and I'm sure there's a lot of folks that weren't with us way back the last time you were as part of the show, I want to go back to how you got started in the game of golf. Because as I recall, neither of your parents played golf. You were a baseball and basketball player as a kid. I think it was your uncle that actually got you started, and he wasn't a big golfer either, oh, by the way. And he played once and thought, hey, maybe Michael would like this. Is that how it came about?
Yeah, that really is. I had an uncle who got invited to a work function. And I say invited, if I remember the story correctly, tried to get out of it. And they basically said, no, you're coming to play golf with us, whether you like it or not. And he really enjoyed it. You know, he was, as anybody would be, who'd literally never, swung a golf club. He was terrible at it, but he really had a good time. And he came to me and I was pretty close to the uncle and still to this day, enjoy spending time with him. And he said, hey, I really think you might, might like this game of golf. And, I literally told him, I think that's dumb. The ball's just sitting there. I was pretty young still, but, it was a pretty good, at least in the small town of Chesterton, a pretty good baseball and basketball player. And, said, I've got enough on my plate, but eventually talked me into it. And we went and played golf and I literally whiffed on the first shot. I hit the ground about a foot behind the ball. Didn't know any better. So I actually knocked the ball off the tee and teed it up and then hit the most majestic shot in all of golf history that went directly over the flag, over the green, and over the road behind the green on this little course in LaPorte, Indiana. That was my first introduction to golf. We played 9 holes that day. And by the following spring, I had read every magazine and a couple books and just loved it. And it's been part of my life, thankfully, since then.
The first tournament you actually sat down and watched was the 86 Masters, right?
Well, the Sunday of the 86 Masters. Yeah, that was the first time I'd ever, I'm sure flipping around, I'm a big sports fan. I mean, is there a chance that there was a golf tournament on, at some point in my life? I mean, there's certainly a chance, but I don't recommend it. I actually don't remember it. And certainly the first time I ever turned on the TV to watch golf, unquestionably, was the 86 Masters. And this was back when, they only showed the back nine on Sunday. So, I watched the Nicklaus charge, and I had certainly heard of Jack Nicklaus, but, I didn't know that he hadn't been playing well in a few years, and it was a big deal. I just remember the roars. I remember Vern Kolunquist yelling, "Yes, sir," and feeling tingles down my spine, and then played a ton of golf that summer. So I went from playing literally one 9-hole round in 85 to 86. I played, legitimately 2 to 4 times a week that whole summer. So, 86 Masters is the first golf tournament I ever watched. It's not a bad one.
Yeah, not a bad one to start with.
Chart. Yeah.
And you talk about when you started playing, you actually played at a place I believe was called Forest Park Golf Course, an older golf course, dates back to 1927, a 9-holer originally that people can still go around now and pay less than $40. You actually paid only a couple of dollars to play, right?
Yeah, so it was 18 holes by the time I started playing. I don't know when they added the second 9, but it was before 86. So yeah, they opened as a 9-hole course, but it's an 18-hole course. And I know for a fact that I paid $3.50 to play 18 holes. And I know that because I didn't come from a whole lot and money was kind of tight. And I took $5 from my paper route money. And $5 got me 18 holes. And then I had $1.50, which usually got me a hot dog. Back then I would have drank a Pepsi. Now it's only Coke Zero, but back then it would have been a hot dog, a Pepsi, and either a Snickers bar or peanut M&Ms. And I literally thought I was, the king of the world at that point in my life to play 18 holes and, grab, usually those three things at the turn. So it was a big deal.
And you got into building clubs, right? For yourself, for your buddies back in a time when fitting wasn't really even a thing yet.
Yeah. So I was, as you mentioned, I'm Purdue engineer. I was working at U.S. Steel and, really passionate, especially, when my baseball days got playing over, really wanted to stay competitive at something. Not that I was a good golfer. I mean, I was a single digit handicap and still am, but I was never never an aspiring pro or anything along those lines. I had found this was back when, Golfsmith and Golfworks out of Ohio and some of those type companies, the component was not too small. It was actually fairly large. And I got into it. I'm a mechanical engineer, so I can figure this out. I can fix some things. I can build some things. I can design some things. I can certainly, those people were affectionately called stick and glue guys. And I said, I can figure this out. And I literally ordered some components and then I started reading, some of the early books on club fitting from guys like Tom Lashon and Golfsmith had some books and I just read it. And I just basically for some friends and, some friends of friends started, quote unquote, fitting them. I look at it now and it's, rudimentary is beyond because it was truly just static fitting. I mean, I checked a lie board, but now, knowing what I know about lie boards. But at the time it was the best anybody could do at the time. There were no launch monitors or anything like that. Certainly not for an individual. I'm not even sure major industries had them at that point. But yeah, I started building clubs and, usually it's one of those things I'd, charge $50 over my cost and then I'd spend $60 on more stuff. So I think every set I built, I lost more money on, but, they helped me buy a swing weight scale or it helped me buy this tool or that tool or, I bought a shaft or a head to test myself. So yeah, I did that for a couple of years and then, again, I was at U.S. Steel and one of the great things about U.S. Steel was if you were young and halfway smart and I was both of those things at that time, they kind of kept promoting you because they wanted to keep you. It's a little bit of an aging workforce. And I got promoted into a job that I really didn't like all that much, which is horrible to say. But I kind of took an inventory of my life. Like, what do I want to do? What do I want to be when I grow up? I was in my, you know, kind of mid to late 20s and was making okay money at the time, especially for that area. But I'm like, I don't know if I can do this the rest of my life. And I applied to literally every golf and baseball company on earth I could find. And I got three interviews, interestingly, one with Wilson Golf, one with Callaway Golf, one with Cleveland Golf. And you know, don't need to go into too much here, but took the Wilson job, and that got me in the industry. And that was late June of 1999. So I've passed 24 years in the golf industry now.
You mentioned LIBOR, and didn't seem like you were all thrilled about what a LIBOR is or utilizing LIBOR. Help me understand: is that the best way for us to figure out what the lie angle needs to be, or in your opinion, is do we need to be looking somewhere else to figure out what the best position is?
Yeah, my opinion, LIBORs are definitely not the right way to go for a number of reasons. You know, one, the balls are, you know, hopefully any kind of decent shot we should be fitting off of, the golf ball's already gone when your club head hits the ground. You know, you're hitting the little ball, the little white golf ball first before you hit the big green ball. The other thing we find is that people can tend to make swings that aren't their natural swings on LIBORs. They're really overemphasizing making sure they get a strike. So, you know, what I really recommend is, you know, we want people to fit lie angle off of ball flight. You know, if you're starting the ball left or having a little hook, you know, on irons, we're going to bend a little flatter. If you're slicing or hitting pushes, we're going to go a little more upright. You know, the only time we really want to look at ground interaction is one of two things. One, if the player just hates the feel of the iron going through the turf, or if it digs in an unusual way. So, you know, if you're an extremely flat or extremely upright, you know, we don't want that toe digging so much that, you know, it affects the swing in a mental way. Again, the ball should be gone. But yeah, we want to fit lie angle off of ball flight in all but the most extreme cases. And the other thing we have now is, you know, launch monitors, you know, Foresight is specifically, but other ones get some really good head data and can provide some really good information on lie as well. So again, 1990s LIBOR with what we knew was fine. But what we know now, again, we really want to fit off ball flight whenever possible.
When I talk to a lot of the guys out on the Champions Tour, they talk about how back in the day, right, before there were launch monitors and TrackMan and all that sort of stuff, the way they had to figure things out is they had to dig it out of the dirt. It sounds like a little bit about what you're doing is going back to old school, seeing instead of looking at all the numbers and all the data, what's the ball doing when it leaves the face of the club? Is that right?
Yeah, I would say it's a combination of old school and new school, right? It is that. We want to see what the ball's doing, but now we want to measure it as well, right? We can look at spin axis. We can look at start lines. You know, so we do want to do that. You know, we want to ask that player, you know, where do you think you're starting the golf ball and where do you want to start the golf ball? Those can sometimes be different things, and we're going to do, you know, we'll work off that. But in a very rudimentary sense, it is going backwards, but with modern technology. So. But yeah, it is. We want to work off ball flight. But again, when I say ball flight, not just the ball flight, but we have great ways and inexpensive ways to get really good ball flight data as well. So again, we're going to look at start line. We're going to look at spin, side spin or spin tilt axis, depending on, you know, the system you're using to help us understand specifically for lie angle. But, you know, we use that for loft as well, right? We're going to look at spin rates. We're going to look at launch angle. But yeah, but in one way it is a step back, but again, a step back with an app tied to it.
Michael, I have to imagine you've seen a tremendous evolution in golf over your time in the game, from the time you were with Wilson to now with Callaway. The clubs, the shafts, the golf balls have all changed so much. Kind of walk us through what you've seen over the course of your career.
Yeah, I've been really blessed, and I mean that just from, and also just kind of random time. But, you know, when I got in the industry, it was really a switchover. I got in the industry when was really kind of that, I was the first generation of real engineers to come in the industry. Before that, it was mainly, and I don't mean this in a negative way, but most of the club designers were golf professionals who didn't quite make it. Really good players. They had an eye for equipment. They could explain themselves. They could listen to others and hear what they wanted. And then, you know, translate that into, hey, we're going to change the toe shape here. You know, it was a lot of grinding, literally taking what was then called a blank, a forging blank, and grinding the club into shape. And then people like me came along with CAD skills and the ability to do digital drafting and then 3D CAD fairly shortly thereafter. And it really did change the industry. And it wasn't just me. There was lots of people like me who kind of came in from that, you know, kind of mid-90s through, you know, really in the early 2000s, that kind of 7-8 year span really changed the industry. And now, you know, it's all CAD. And not only that, but now we have artificial intelligence tools and ways to collect data that was literally unimaginable in 99 when I joined the industry. So, you know, the ability, you know, we're really getting out of, well, I like the shape of this and I like the shape of that. We have great tools where we can, you know, get data. We can pull hundreds of people. We can get players out to our test center and ask them very specific questions about different things. And then again, you know, see how they're delivering the club, how they, you know, how the ball flight goes at different settings, if you will. And different prototypes. So, you know, in my 24 years, again, I came in a really interesting time. And now that technology is just booming, you know, AI, you know, especially at Callaway and some of the great things that we've done with products. We, you know, we've advertised that. Now other companies are starting to dip their toe in AI a little as well. But, you know, you hear about AI in all industries. And I'm just grateful to be at a company that's a leader in that space and get to work with some amazing people that can help me use that in fitting. You know, I like to be a data guy, but, you know, data analytics and those type of things is a special skill and special training to be able to utilize and analyze, you know, data sets of thousands of millions of shots. And it's great that we have that type of tool.
Okay, so you mentioned AI. And now some of my listeners would be like, you got to be kidding me. AI is coming into my golf game now? So how are you guys utilizing AI to make things better?
So, yeah, I mean, it's really into club design and, you know, getting into other aspects of golf. But, you know, we can analyze things digitally in hundreds and thousands of iterations through artificial intelligence. And it can design things that humans couldn't design from thicknesses, from materials, from how clubs react from launch and spin, depending on where it hit on the face. And really, you know, again, going back old school, we would certainly test the club and we might get 40, 50, even 100 people to hit shots. But now we can digitally hit shots, if you will, through, you know, algorithms of ball flight and testing different golf balls and different club deliveries. You know, we can literally simulate outside to in shots, inside to out shots, inside to out path swing, shots off the toe, shots off the heel. And we can find out what we expect that ball and that club head to do for those interactions. And we can run through those simulations tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of times, and then tell the supercomputer through artificial intelligence, you know, minimize weight on this or make the spin the most consistent across the face. You know, we want to maximize ball speed in this area because this player type might miss it, you know, more center toe compared to more center heel. But we can do all those things simultaneously. So we can solve for multiple problems at once, which again, the human mind, you know, we struggle with. So it really is amazing to have this team. And, you know, anyone can buy a supercomputer, but the key is to be able to ask the right questions, analyze the data in the right way, and then ask that supercomputer very specific questions and have them solve it. Now that's simplifying it a little bit. But that really the way it works, it's a series of iterations and simulations where we can hone in make tiny changes to really maximize the performance of every aspect of a golf product. And that's, you know, we've been doing it on clubs and that'll get into golf balls and that'll get into fitting and that will get into lots of other aspects of the game as time marches on.
So, Michael, with all of the advancements, the big topic, right, is around this model local rule and rolling the golf ball back and Jay Monahan saying the PGA Tour is not going to do that. We'll see where that ends up because we know that the USGA, the RNA, and oh, by the way, Augusta National and Fred Ridley said they supported that. So if that's not the way we end up going, and I can't imagine that someone like your company at Callaway or any of the big manufacturers would have supported a rollback of the golf ball because I got to imagine it's millions of dollars to retool manufacturing plants that are making millions upon millions of golf balls every year. So I would think if we're going to go one way or another, it's either all going to fall back on the golf course setup, possibly. And that's what we were talking about with Richard Zokel in the last segment. Or some folks have talked about retooling the clubs. I mean, where do you think this thing ends up?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Obviously, the USGA has a hard job. I mean, I don't want to take any official stances on the model local rule. I mean, there's lots of people putting input. But, you know, the USGA's job is, at least their self-professed job, is to govern the game of golf. And it's a really interesting time right now, right? Because some professionals are saying, well, hey, we want to have some authority in how we define the rules as well. So, I think eventually it will all get sorted out. You know, there's been other rules controversies with grooves and CT and, well, you know, so then COR and now CT and head size. I mean, some people might remember that, you know, there were some 500 and 600 CC drivers, and, you know, the rule got set at 460. So, you know, it's a complicated question, you know, with golf courses, with water management, with professional players and manufacturers. Again, there certainly is complex. And but I will say this, you know, I don't think there's too many average golfers who hit the ball too far who complain like, boy, I didn't have any fun today because the ball went way too far for me. So, you know, I really want it to work out best for all. I'm not sure exactly what that means. Again, it's a complicated problem, but golf is booming right now. That's great to see. We're getting a more diverse from age and ethnicity and literally across the spectrum of getting more players in the game. And that's what I love to see, right? We're getting people and families. You know, COVID certainly wasn't a good thing in any way, but it did bring people to golf. It was a way to be outside and a way to spend time as a family. And a lot of that is continuing on. So, you know, the most important thing to me is that golf continues to grow. We continue to welcome new people, and, you know, the equipment stuff will get sorted out as time goes on. There's lots of really smart people who will take care of that, and we'll all adjust. Whatever those rules are, you know, we always want to make conforming golf clubs and conforming golf balls. We want the best players in the world to use our product. And we're very proud of people like John Rahm and Xander Schauffele, who represent the brand, Sam Burns and Rose Zhang, and on and on and on. And, you know, we will always make sure that we have the best product for whatever the rules are for them. So we'll just keep plugging along, and that'll sort itself out over time.
Michael, two quick ones before I let you go. And I saw a tweet from earlier this year, a picture of you at a hole in one back in March. Tell us about your hole in one.
It finally happened. After good gracious, so many years in the game to finally, and I've had some really, really close calls, you know, some at some average courses, you know, one at Spyglass that I'll never forget, but didn't quite go down. This was played with a friend of mine, Zach Zortman, who's on Twitter, and he actually flew out to get fit at Callaway, and we played Goat Hill Park, which is just one of the great, really great golf social experiments in a positive way. So welcoming, and happened to get on the ninth hole and threw a Chrome Soft XLS on the ground and knocked a sand wedge about 114 in the air and spun it right back in the jar like it was supposed to, and Finally had my hole in one. It was, I'm not on camera right now, but I have a stupid grin on my face right now, just thinking about it. Every time it gets brought up, I just get giddy. It's, you know, it's the only time we're perfect in life, right? I mean, we try real hard, but golf is hard and life is hard, but every once in a while, even, you know, random guys like me can make a perfect swing. And, that was one of them. So, just a great day that I will never forget.
I saw a congratulatory tweet from Shane LeBaron. Shane was on the show a couple of weeks ago. Have you worked on your game with Shane?
Yeah, I've known Shane. Shane and I met, good gracious, probably close to 20 years, 15, 18 years ago now. I don't take lessons officially from Shane, but every time I have a swing problem, Shane is the first and only person I call. I cannot recommend his ability to simplify the golf swing and make it understandable and really get to the root cause. You know, again, I'm just such a fan of his. He doesn't quite get the accolades he deserves, but, you know, he's director of instruction at Cherry Hills, which is, you know, unquestionably a top 100 course, USAM starting there next week. You know, he's worked with David Duvall. He's worked with lots of other pros. He works with a bunch of college players. So Shane is a dear friend. and also happens to be, in my mind, a golf swing genius. So yeah, I know Shane very well. If he lived closer, I might abuse that friendship and work with him too much. So it's probably good that he lives a little far away.
Yeah, I'm a huge Shane LeBaron fan as well. He's a great guy.
Anybody who meets Shane is a huge Shane LeBaron fan, and they should be.
Michael, before I let you go, remind our listeners, how can we stay up to date with all the great things you're doing there, whether it's following you online or it's on social media?
Yeah, I'm at VGolfMan, the letter V, G-O-L-F-M-A-N. I'm on Twitter often, try to be on there every day. You know, sometimes the day job gets in the way, but I do a Monday golf poll every Monday. I do random golf thoughts on Friday and mix some other stuff in between. I'm also on Instagram at VGolfMan. I don't post much, but I do certainly comment about golf stuff on there as well. But Twitter's the best way. And I love having conversations on there. I've made some real life friends and it's been great. So I know some people are a little negative about Twitter sometimes, but I think it's a good place. You can meet people, you can share information. So that's the best way to find me.
Well, Michael, I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your busy schedule to come back and be a part of the show again. Way too much time had passed, so my apologies on that. I hope I get the privilege of catching up with you much, much sooner this next time around.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks, Chris. It's always great to talk to you, and we'll make sure it's not too many years before I do this again. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Michael. Take care, my friend. All the best to you and your family. We'll catch up soon.
Bye.
See you, Michael. That is the great Michael Verska, folks, and just an equipment genius. That guy knows a ton about the golf swing and the golf equipment. Verska, his last name is spelled V-R-S-K-A. So Michael Verska is where you'll find him, and at VGolfMan, both on Twitter and on Instagram. Like I say, it was a number of years since the last time I got to have Michael as part of the show. I'll make sure it's not that many years going forward. Hopefully we get to have him on before the end of this year and see what's ahead at Callaway Golf. Okay, coming up next is one of the most positive, energetic, and upbeat guys who just happens to be one of the best hockey analysts in the game and a big golf enthusiast, and that is Darren Pang. Before I get to Panger, power and precision. Adele Golf's SMS and SMS Pro irons offer the ultimate in iron adjustability. Featuring the revolutionary swing match weighting technology, precisely dial in each iron to your swing by moving the heaviest weight to its optimal position for maximum performance. Learn more about them by going to adelgolf.com. And folks, do you sway and you're off balance in your golf swing? You know what? It could be your shoes. A golf shoe needs structure to provide stability and reduce sway. How can you tell if your shoes lack structure and are hurting your game? If you can hold your shoes by the toe and heel and twist it, toss it. Squares was designed for the perfect balance of structure and comfort. Isn't it time you tried Squares? Try the new Speedbolt at squares.com. That's squairz.com. Looking for the ultimate Myrtle Beach golf experience? Well, it's only a click away. Check out the two-play special at two of America's most awarded public golf courses, Caledonia Golf and Fish Club and True Blue Golf Club. They are low country masterpieces featuring two iconic Mike Strantz designs. Play these two incredible courses for one great price. Visit CaledoniaGolfAndFishClub.com to learn more about the two-play special and book your tee time today. Again, that's CaledoniaGolfAndFishClub.com. Okay, now back in Next on the Tee with me is former Chicago Blackhawks goalie and a new member of the Blackhawks broadcast team for next season, Darren Pang. Let me remind you about Panger's background. He grew up in Nepean, Ontario. He played youth hockey for the Nepean Raiders alongside Red Wings Hall of Famer Steve Yzerman and a guy who is a great friend of this show, Dan Quinn. Darren was the first goalie drafted by the expansion Belleville Bulls of the Ontario Hockey League. In 1984, he helped the Ottawa 67s win the OHL's Memorial Cup, and he was named top goalie and to the All-Star team. He was signed as a free agent by the Blackhawks later that season, got called up and played one game with Chicago in 1984, but he was there full-time starting in 1987, got his first win that year in October against the Winnipeg Jets. He set the Blackhawk record for 6 assists in a game by a goalie that season, and he played in the league until 1990. For the last several years, Darren was a member of the broadcast team for the St. Louis Blues, along with doing a number of games for the NHL Network and Sportsnet. He will forever live in my heart for the great job he has done during the Winter Olympics. And again, this coming season, he'll be back in Chicago doing the Blackhawk games. And I am honored he is with me again tonight here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Panger, how are you? Thanks for coming back on the show.
You know, I'm doing fantastic. In fact, just listening to all the information from at V Golf, man. And you know me, I love my golf. So I love my Mira clubs and I love to listen to whatever anybody else has information wise. And although hockey is my passion, I think I work in hockey to pay for golf, to be quite honest with you. I love it that much. So that might be the best way for me to describe it. And it's funny you mentioned Danny Quinn, who's a longtime friend of mine. We were 6 years old when we first started playing hockey together. And when we were about 12, 13, and then we were about 17, 18, Danny kept saying to me, why are you playing tennis and squash and racquetball? You got to play golf. And, you know, growing up, I didn't play golf. And now every time Quinn and I talk to each other, he goes, see, I told you you'd love golf. And so anyway, thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it. And also I appreciate you sending those very nice, kind-hearted tweets as you always do every weekend. You had a lot of great people and you're a really nice man that brings a lot of people together. So I appreciate that.
I appreciate that very much, Darren. So you mentioned Mira Golf and you're a Mira Golf mm-hmm. brand ambassador. We talked a little bit about this last time, but for those who weren't a part of that show, remind us what's in your bag.
Right now, I've got the CB302s, actually. Just got them. My good friend, Bill Holawati, who was originally a Vancouver native, is the COO of Mira and a dear friend of mine. It's been over 16 years that I've been with Mira. Out of a chance meeting at a golf tournament in Vancouver with my good friend, Grant Fuhr, the Hall of Fame goaltender. And I ran into Bill and I said, are those Miras, the famous Mira clubs? And he said, they sure are. And I said, can I try one? And so he said, I'll send you a 6-iron with a couple of different shafts in them. And I have about maybe 8 different models of the Mira. So right now I'm blending the new CB302s, which are beautiful, but I'm combining them with the wedge 9 and 8 of the MC501s. A little bit smaller, and I'm finding that to be a really nice combination right now. And I always use the Acura shafts. And a shout out to my boys in Kingston, Ontario, knowing that you read the bio, but I'm an Ottawa native, which is very close to Kingston. And Kingston, Ontario, has produced those Acura irons, and I've loved them to death. And those guys are phenomenal guys. They do a great job. So I got the I-85s, and I've got the Tour Z5 proto driver shaft with the 65 grams in it right now. So I'm giving that a go and it's been terrific so far. Great combination.
Mira Golf did a video with Adam Scott. I don't know if you saw it, where he visited.
Yes, I did.
He went down there to the manufacturing plant. And what captured my attention is how meticulous they are and how they build these things handmade, kind of one at a time, if you will, in order to get them just right. I mean, it's amazing what they go through and how well handcrafted their golf clubs are.
I tell you what, I couldn't agree with you more. I actually have seen many hockey players, you know, go through the grinding of their sticks, their blades, the lie, the curve, the flex actually in hockey. And then I watched that and I asked my friend Bill Holawati, I said, Billy, if ever you need me to go to Japan and do that, I'm all in. I was so pumped up. I mean, there's Adam Scott. I mean, it's not exactly the most, you know, I mean, he's not going to the Four Seasons there in Japan. You saw it. I mean, you know, this is old school, grinded out, industrial, hard work, and hand forged. The clubs are all from Japan. They're hand forged from Japan. And so I really, every time there's something out there, Chris, I watch every single one of them and I sweat because they all seem to be really hot and sweaty while they're doing that. And I watch Adam Scott just look and stare at these irons and I'm like, that is so great. I get so pumped up watching stuff like that. And the information that we can now get on, whether it's that YouTube on Mira or just social media for any clubs, I'm not just pumping, you know, Mira, they're my friends, and but everybody, they do such a great job of giving us information as to what might work for us. And Mirror works for me. It has for 16 years. But to see Adam Scott go in there and grind it out, I thought that was fantastic.
Yeah, I agree. Penga, you're a member, right, at Prestwick Village Golf Club up in up in Michigan. It's one of the top clubs in the country. I mean, you go back to a few years ago, they had the 10th Michigan Open at the club. Talk about your golf club.
It's a wonderful golf club in a very small hidden gem of an area in Highland, Michigan. And I'm very fortunate because I've got a little place on Duck Lake, which there's a million lakes in Michigan. There could be a Harvey Lake, a White Lake, a Duck Lake, you know, upper straits, lower straits. There's a load of them. And there's some great golf courses, obviously. But this club is really neat because I got a couple of, well, one former NHLer, Joe Koser, a real tough guy that played for the Detroit Red Wings. He's a member there. And a number of guys that I went to Scotland and Ireland and up in northern Michigan with on trips, and it is world-class greens, always running 11 and a half to 12 and a half on the stimp, large greens, easily three puttable, very fair but firm, good golf course. But I get out, you know what, Michigan is so great. I get out to a good friend of mine's a member at Bloomfield Hills Country Club in Oakland Hills, and I've played so many other courses there, and they're just, it's just a, honestly, if I could use a broadcasting term, which I'm not this smart to use this word, but I'll say a plethora of great golf courses in the Michigan area. Crystal Downs and Arcadia Bluffs are two of my favorites when I go up north to northern Michigan. So if you've never been there, please give yourself an opportunity to go up to Michigan at some point. Play any course out there. You're not going to be disappointed.
When I look at the video flyovers of Prestwick and looking at each of the holes, you got a lot of sand out there. And then the three finishing holes look pretty darn challenging. Yeah, what's it like when you've got a good round going, knowing that 16, 17, and 18 are still to go? They look pretty intimidating.
It's a great call because once you finish number 12, you go to the back. And most guests that I bring out, they go, whoa, this feels like northern Michigan because it goes, you know, it goes from a little more, not open, but less tree lined. And then you hit this spot on 13, and it's a tight tree line hole, not very long, but big bunkers on the right, OB on the left. And then you turn around, and most of the big hitters can try to drive the green on 14. But if they hit it awry, I'm not a long hitter, so I just hit what I normally hit and try to hit a wedge in tight. And then you hit 15, tree lined again, long par five, but for the big boys, they can hit it. What you're talking about, Chris, which I love about Prestwick Village, is 16, a beautiful golf hole, water on the left, trees on the right, uphill, and then you've got 17, a signature par three, you know, placed from 205 for us. We'll probably play it from 168 to 205, and it's downhill, bunkering on the right, a terrific par three, and then the 18th hole is a really good finishing hole that, you know, water on the right, bunkers on the left, uphill. And for a guy like me, if we're playing the blues, you know, I might have 170 to 190 in. If I'm playing the golds, I'm probably at 210, 220 in on a real tight green. And I just think it's a really good final three holes. And again, I think the compliment would be that the greens are excellent. I mean, I get a kick out of it because when I come from St. Louis, that I'm there in the winter normally, now I'm going to be in Chicago a lot. But I get to the guys in Michigan and I say, boy, these greens are running great. And I think they're about an 11. And they're sour that they're 11. They want them at 13. So I'm like, oh, man, you have no idea how great you have it here. So it's easily three puttable. Super greens, great, everybody that runs the golf course, they take a great deal of pride in saying, this is our golf course. If a guest is going to come here, we want to make sure that they're going to three putt a few times. It's going to be fair, but it's going to be tough for them.
And I hear the practice range there is spectacular. I mean, it's a top 50 range. According to PGA Magazine, you got a huge short game area, 9-hole putting course. There has got to be a great place to get your game in shape.
Well, you're right about that. It's I think it's the second largest in all of Michigan, which says a lot, but it's 25 acres. Like, you can sit there. Like, last year I was getting ready to go to Ireland and Scotland. We got a great group of guys led by former Red Wing GM Ken Holland, who's now with the Edmonton Oilers, and he's just a genius leader in getting us on these trips. But I remember thinking to myself, okay, we're going to play Royal County Down and Royal Portrush, and we're going to go over to Troon, and we're going to go up to Royal Dornoch, and the winds are going to change. So let's just hit balls into the wind. So 25 acres, bays surround it in a horseshoe, and you can just find whatever winds you want to find. And then there's chipping areas all like in 1, 2, 4 quadrants. And then there's a big chipping area, and then there's a putting area, and then you hit the first tee. So yeah, I think that's kind of it's a huge plus for guys that want to grind it a little bit, get in the dirt. I think Ben Hogan would have really liked that. I mean, that's 25 acres. Imagine Ben Hogan digging the dirt in there. Right. He'd be there all day long. And especially when the sun doesn't go down till 9:45 PM. So there's a lot of benefits to Michigan golf.
So you just rattled off some of the greatest courses in our game over there in Ireland and Scotland. So now you got to tell us, what was that like?
Phenomenal. I've probably played Royal County Down. I don't know. I might have played it maybe 15 to 20 times, and Portrush the same thing. So our trips are well done. We've also played great courses like Port Stewart, and we've also played Tralee and Ballybunion. But the ones that our group likes to play are the championship courses. So when we jump down to, you know, we take the ferry over to back to Scotland, and we play Turnberry. We might go up and play Carnoustie and maybe the Old Course and Muirfield. But this particular trip last year, late August, we went up to Royal Dornoch. I've never been there. It's one of the few courses I haven't played. And now I understand the influence of Donald Ross. Now I understand how he is such a genius with every facet of the putting green. And I feel like, because I'm not a long hitter, I feel like I pride myself on my short game, chipping, putting, being creative. And I got to tell you, I went to Royal Dornoch and I was just in love with it. And I made some bad shots. I made some good shots. I made some frustrating shots. And it was like, wow, this is Donald Ross at his best. If you've never been to Royal Dornoch in the Inverness area in Northern Scotland, you've got to get there because it is spectacular. Absolutely spectacular.
So you mentioned St. Andrews amongst all of that. So I want to live vicariously through you for a minute. What's it like the first time you stand on the first tee at St. Andrews?
Well, honestly, I thought it was a parkland golf course. I was with a number of friends, including, my buddies always say I have this saying, I hate to name drop because Robert De Niro told me never to do that. But I was with a couple of greats, Alan Trammell, the great baseball player for the Tigers the first time I played it, and Steve Yzerman, and a fellow named Bob Moran. And Bob Moran sat in line at 5 a.m. to get us out there, and we got out there. And I remember standing on the first tee the first time. That was 1997. And I went like, what's this all about? I hit a fade, or you can aim to the left and hit it wherever. And then you get there to your second shot, and there's that little creek, and you go, oh boy, tight turf. Don't dunk it in the water, you know? So the first time I played, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to go. I couldn't see the golf course. And the second time I played, I saw it a little bit better. And then I played it probably 4 or 5 times since then. And it wasn't until, this is just me, but it wasn't until maybe the fourth time that I played the old course that I went, oh, wow, that's where you got to hit it. That's where you got to hit it. And then I had a great appreciation for what the old course was all about. I think it's fascinating. And for those naysayers that are out there that have only played it once, please go play it a few more times if you can, because I think you'd have a great appreciation for the left side of the course and just the nuances of it. And especially coming in on, you know, 16, 17, and 18 and seeing the fans, I'll say the patrons, they're taking pictures. There's a photographer there that'll give you pictures. It's like, it's something that's out of this world. So I think it was Alan Trammell that hits a big cut. And I remember him hitting a big cut, and I think it went into the Rustics Hotel, bounced, came back, hit the hotel, might have hit the top of a Toyota like a van and came back in play, and he was in the fairway and he had a 70 yard shot coming in. I'm like, that is golf right there. So I it was really fascinating and really enjoyable to play the old course for sure.
So closer to home, as all the years that you were in St. Louis with the Blues and obviously now going back to Chicago where you played, there's got to be some, I'm guessing on the off days, you played some pretty good courses in and around St. Louis and up in the Chicagoland area. What are some of your favorites over there?
Well, for sure in Missouri, I'm a member still at Meadowbrook Country Club in Baldwin, and it is a fantastic golf course. You know, just a really good, like, zoysia fairways, great greens, small. You got to hit your targets. So I love there, but I'm not afraid to say that Belle Reve is just a masterful piece of land. Boone Valley, that's owned by the Taylor family that own Enterprise, built that, and it's a little bit further out, but there's nothing around it, and that is spectacular. But you got St. Louis Country Club and old CB McDonald, Seth Rainer, sitting right there. You got old Warson that hosted, I think, the 71. You might need to correct me on this. I think it was the 71 Ryder Cup right there. So great golf courses there. And in Chicago, I was a member for years at Aurora Country Club. You know, Tom Bendelow designed a lot of courses around here along with Donald Ross. But my most favorite for sure, if I could die, Chris, and go to heaven tomorrow and someone said you could play one last course for the rest of your life, I'd say Chicago Golf Club. Stevie McDonald, Seth Rainer in Wheaton, Illinois. I lived alongside it. No one lives on the course. There's no homes on it. But a former neighbor of mine was a president, Steve Wilkinson, and he would drive by and he'd say, 7 o'clock tomorrow, Darren. And I'd say, I'll change all plans, 7 o'clock tomorrow. Like, I just love that golf course. Chicago Golf Club to me is just it's like you're passing through in time, and it's a wonderful golf course. My favorite.
Golf is a big thing in your family as well. As I recall from our last conversation, your son Tyler is a golf pro. He's worked at a couple of different courses over the years. How's he doing?
That's really, you know what? My son Tyler is a tremendous young man that actually just gave up the golf business. He's got three little girls under the age of three, and they're actually going to come to Michigan and come see us at the lake in a week and a half or so. And, he was just getting a little frustrated with how little time he got to spend in the summertime. So he's able to play golf now. And I'm really proud to say that he's a school teacher and he and his wife are in Middlesex, New Jersey. Yeah. And he's just turned it around and he says, you know what? I'm going to have my summers with my kids. I'm going to be able to play some golf and come visit me and maybe play in some member guests. So I'm very proud of him. He's done a great job and he's a great dad, which I'm even more proud of than anything else.
Absolutely. And your nephew, Jake Bryson, is another very good player in the family. He's played in the U.S. Junior Amateur Championship. How's he doing?
Yeah, Jake's doing great. He turned pro, went to Utah Valley. Played 4 years there on a scholarship, played D1, you know, so played D1 golf, had some great experiences there. I actually had him in St. Louis last summer and he did some caddying at Belle Reve in Meadowbrook and turned pro. He's been grinding it out, played in a Canadian, I guess you would call it a Canadian tour event in Ottawa at Dunrobin at Eagle Creek. He did not make the cut, but it was his home course. He's played that course 1,000 times. I think there's a lot of pressure on Jake. He's a wonderful kid. Hits the ball a mile. He's a left-hander. Typical, Chris, of Canadians. A lot of Canadians followed Mike Weir, I think, and are left-handed golfers. And he pounds it straight. He's a good kid. He treats people well. And I think he's going to do real well in this business.
Panger, just a couple more before I let you go. And we've sort of danced around the fact that you're on your way back to Chicago to be the broadcast analyst for the Blackhawks next season. But I have to imagine the decision to leave St. Louis and to leave the Blues organization had to come with a lot of anxieties. You were there as a part of their only Stanley Cup championship. You became a big part of that community. How'd you go about making that decision? Really had to be something tugging at your heartstrings.
Yeah, well, I'm right now in Chicago. I flew here this morning for the funeral service of Rocky Works. the great owner of the Chicago Blackhawks. And yes, you're right. Anxiety filled is the right way to describe it. It's a hard decision. I think for anybody out there that have had to make hard decisions, there's a burden of, there's a weight, there's anxiety that fills you. And the people of St. Louis were phenomenal to me and my family. And I went there as a broadcaster that never played for the Blues. And for anybody that's broadcast team sports, you know, that's a very, it's a challenging thing, but you know what? I love the people of St. Louis and it was a love affair for 14 years. So to go through it, there's some financial things that you've probably heard about with a lot of regional networks and Bally Sports in Midwest or Bally Sports overall, or they're going through some challenging times. The Chicago Blackhawks came in, Rocky Wirtz called me, Danny Wirtz's son that I used to teach at a hockey rink when he was 12, 13 and 14. He was a goalie. And I went out there because of a call from Rocky. They both called me and asked if I'd come back to Chicago. And so what a return it is for me. I got to tell you, Chris, it's, you know, to see some old teammates and to come back here, the only team I ever played for in the NHL. I liked a kid, and I think Wayne Gretzky said it best. He said, nobody got more out of 27 career wins than you did, because that's all I won in the NHL. I didn't play that long, but to come back to Chicago and to, you know, to be a broadcaster here and at a time when Rocky Wirtz just passed away, and it's a challenging time without a great leader like that. But to see Connor Bedard, the first overall pick, and, you know, knowing that Jonathan Toews or Patrick Kane, the guys that led them to the three Stanley Cups, that's over with now. And now it's a new regime, and I'm part of that, kind of a new part of it. So I'm very excited about being back here in Chicago and being part of the broadcast. So thanks for asking that, because it always means a lot to me, because the people in St. Louis mean a lot to me, and they know that. So, but I'm looking forward to the next page, and this is it. This might be the last page. Who the heck knows? But if it is, it's where I started. And if I end here, then that's awesome.
You mentioned being a part of the new regime. Blackhawks have been struggling last couple of seasons, had kind of a down year last year. What's your expectation? How long do you think it's going to take for the Blackhawks to go from where they are to back to being able to challenge for a Stanley Cup?
Well, that's always a troublesome question, because you don't know. Like, look at some of the great teams that have really tried hard to get back to winning again that were winners before. Like, Detroit's a great example. And I tell you what, the late owner there, Mike Ilitch, is a phenomenal person, a local businessman. Rocky Wirtz, Chicago, same thing. And they built their empire on winning and bringing the people back. And, you know, it takes Detroit a while, and they've had some good picks. Chicago, though, has the benefit of getting the lucky number one overall at a time in which Connor Bedard is a phenomenal young prospect. So how long will it take? You know, I would have to think that when you have a player like that, if you look at Edmonton with Connor McDavid or other players that have had first overall picks, even Hischier in New Jersey, and then they had Hughes, and then they had, like, they've had some good picks, and look how quickly they picked up. So is it 5 years to be in the playoffs or 3 years to be in the playoffs and 5 years to compete? I'd probably say 3 years in the playoffs and 5 years to compete again and get into the playoffs. I think one thing I should say, it's very important to get your young players into a playoff series, because I know as a media guy how different it is. It's everybody's in your locker room. More networks are talking. So you want to put pressure on your young kids so they experience it. Whether they win early or not, it doesn't matter. But you want them to experience what it's like being in the heat and in the fire. And then you find out what kind of athletes you have when it comes down to that.
Hanger, one more before I let you go, and I want to go back to golf for this last one. We just saw Brian Harman win the Open Championship. What'd you think about what you saw from him?
Love the little bald left-hander. Are you kidding me? Man, oh man. I sent a tweet out, and in fact, I'm in a pool, and I picked Brian to win. And my reasoning was, and there was, I think we had 198 players or 202 players, something like that. And I think six of us picked Harman to win it. And my explanation was, I love the mallet putter in the wind. And they talked about you have to hit a draw, you know, into the wind there in England. And I'm thinking, that Harmon, he can hit whatever he wants to hit. And I always like him. He's just got a great center of gravity, and he's got a, you know, I like his swing. It's simple. And I even though I'm right-handed and he's left-handed, I kind of watch it and I'm like, whoa, I like this guy. So I always pick Brian Harmon. So I was very excited to see him win. And also, like, I use a phrase in hockey, a little guy with gumption. And it's something that I back up a lot of little guys, because I'm one of the smallest goalies to ever play in the NHL. But it's like, it's not really about that. It's about what you have inside when the pressure's on and how much gumption you have when there's a bit of a battle. So I was really happy to see a guy that's been top 10, and he always competes. But this was a perfect tournament, I thought, for Brian Harmon to win. And by the way, I loved that smirkish, like, smile that he had in the presentation when they asked him, want an umbrella, and he said, it's been raining on me all day, I'll be fine. Like, he just had something about him that I really admired, and I'd love to meet Brian Harmon at some point in my life.
What'd you think about the story he told about the guy that was along the ropes as he walked by on Saturday, who yelled out to him, hey, Harmon, you don't have the stones for this?
Yeah, there's something about being a little guy. And I remember my first game in the NHL, I was backing up. I was called up from Milwaukee of the IHL to Chicago. I backed up against the Montreal Canadiens, a team that I adored. I couldn't stop staring at Larry Robinson and Bob Gainey and Guy Lafleur and you name it. And Larry Robinson, who's a wonderful man, stopped Doug Wilson, who was our defenseman, who's a Hall of Famer. And he stopped him and he said, hey, where's the other half of your goalie? And of course, that was, you know, wow. That was me. I'm 5'4.5". I'm 135 pounds. And I probably did look like a goalie that should be playing Pee Wee or Bantam. And anyway, I remember Doug told me that after, and I'm like, okay. And then I went to, you know, I next year I didn't make the team. I could tell I wasn't good enough. And I'm like, I need to be better. Next year I didn't make the team, but I had a better training camp. I said, I got to get better. I need more intestinal fortitude or more, you know, like. And so I think that's great. I think what that person said to Brian Harmon was perfect for Brian Harmon. Like that's what makes it. Like, just because you're tall, good looking, and slender doesn't mean you're going to win everything. Like, you need some gumption. You need some intestinal fortitude, I like to say. So it was great to see Brian Harmon do that. And I mean, shove that warm beer. You know what I'm talking about.
I do. Panger, before I let you go, remind our listeners, how can we stay up to date with all the great things you're doing and follow you, whether it's online or it's on social media?
Well, I'm on at Panger40, has always been my Twitter account. And a lot of the hockey guys follow me, not for my hockey acumen. They like to know what golf trips I've gone on in my life. And also my, you know, mirror, I've got Johnny O's is on tap. But, you know, Catherine Tappan, unbelievable person and reporter. She's done so much in whether it be on NBC or in the NHL. Anyway, we're gonna have a podcast starting up in sometime about mid-September called Back to You. And so we're excited about that. And you'll see me on TNT as well. I just signed a new 3-year deal with them and with the Blackhawks here on NBC Sports Network Chicago. So on Instagram, I'm terrible on Instagram, but it's Darren R. Pang, if you want to follow me there. So I appreciate you saying that. And hopefully people follow and I can humor them a little bit.
There you go. Darren, I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your busy schedule to come back and be a part of the show. You're just one of the most wonderful, positive, energetic people that someone gets to meet in this life. And I've been privileged now to have you as part of this show twice. And I hope I get that privilege again sometime soon.
That sounds great. Chris, anytime. I love being on the show and I love talking about life, hockey, golf. And again, I'm gonna stay in hockey for as long as I can just to pay for my golf.
No doubt. That's fantastic. Panger, take care, my friend. All the best to you and your family. Look forward to catching up with you again soon.
All right. Take care. Thank you.
See you, Darren. That is the great Darren Pang, folks, and it just doesn't get any better than that guy. Just like I said, one of the most positive, energetic people you get to meet in this life, and he brings that energy to everything he does as an announcer and as a broadcaster is fantastic. And like I say, he made his way into my heart with all the great things that he's done on the Olympic broadcast. And then he obviously is great on for the St. Louis Blues, and he's be even better now with the Chicago Blackhawks back where he got his start. But a fantastic offer. Listen to the amazing courses that he's played multiple times. How awesome is that? I mean, I'm jealous as I could be. So we'll pick his brain a little bit more on some of the details about some of those great places next time around. Be sure to give him a follow at Panger40 on Twitter, Darren R. Pang on Instagram. And looking forward to he and Catherine Tappan doing their own podcast Back to You starting next month. So we'll stay up to date with what that's like and hopefully get to plug that a little bit for Darren along the way as well and get him back on the show again soon and talk about those amazing trips. And then probably a little bit about what's going on in the hockey season as well with the Blackhawks. Folks, before I close up shop tonight, you've heard me talk about some great products that I saw at the PGA Merchandise Show. And another one that stood out to me is On Point Golf. Game-changing, three-dimensional ball markers that science shows will help us see the line better when we're putting and therefore make more putts and lower our scores. See for yourself why Jim Furyk and I are big fans by going online to onpointgolf.us. All right, my friends, it is time for me to put a bow on this edition of Next on the Tee. My sincere thanks go out again to Tom Patrick, Richard Zokel, Michael Verska, and Darren Pang for joining me this week. Scheduled to join me next week are LPGA legend Jane Blaylock is going to be back. Always a good time getting to spend some time with Jane. We'll also get a return visit from a wonderful friend of the show, Mark Kalkovecchia, and Kalk makes the segment so much fun, so looking forward to having him back as well. Rich Katz, who was the CEO of Billy Casper Golf for many years and is now consulting with the new Golf Nation platform. He'll be making his next On the Tee debut, and Rich is a fantastic guy. And then we're going to round things out with a return visit from a guy who was just on just not all that long ago, probably just a few weeks ago, actually. Adaptive golf instructor Joe Grohman will be back as part of the show. So it's going to be a fun time next week, folks. I hope you'll come back and be a part of it with us. Folks, you can find the show available as a podcast just about anywhere you get your podcast content. In particular, we're out there on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Audio Boom, Player.fm, Good Pods. And like I said at the top of the show, it's such a thrill to have this show now available out there on Trib Live. It's an honor and a privilege, and I thank those folks very, very much. But most of all, my thanks go out to all of you for being the greatest supporters in the history of podcasts. I appreciate you all so very much. Until next week, hit 'em straight, my friends.